today is actually part of a project that Russell and I are currently working on. And this project and my talk today focuses on critters that don't often make an appearance in ethical analysis. Critters such as spiders, insects, and mollusks. I'm a philosopher of science by training. I became interested in invertebrates when I was looking into how the concept of simplicity may have shaped approaches to the study of animal minds. Insects and spiders, like the tiny jumping spider, might appear to be paradigm examples of simple systems. And so one might expect that their behavior can be explained by equally simple mechanisms. Until, that is, you look closer. It turns out that many of their behaviors, which have been replicated in experiments, rival those of more sophisticated vertebrates. Bioethics has had a lot to say about the treatment of vertebrates, but has yet to make contact with the growing scientific evidence of invertebrate minds. And that's the subject of today's talk, especially as it concerns their treatment in scientific and biomedical research. Now, invertebrates account for the vast majority of animals. On some estimates, invertebrates account for, or invertebrate animals account for, roughly 90% of all animal species. They range from the sessile and brainless sea sponge to social learners, such as bumblebees, to flexible problem solvers like octopuses. And yet, despite this diversity, and despite their great numbers, invertebrates as a group are generally excluded from moral analysis, and as a consequence, from experimental welfare protections. And this is so despite the fact that invertebrates are dramatically overrepresented as research animals. A recent exception has actually been made in some quarters for octopuses, but even this moral accolade, in fact, betrays a vertebrate-centric analysis of approaches to animal welfare. Now, to the extent that invertebrates are considered at all in ethics, this is limited primarily to the conservation context, where their value is regarded as instrumental in terms of the ecological services that they provide. And the exclusion of invertebrates as a category would be rational were all invertebrates mindless biological automata, were they clearly ineligible for that reason for moral concern. But this is inconsistent with the evidence, which presses us to consider what a moral comprehensive and scientifically engaged animal ethics and policy might look like. So I'll start today by showing that the vertebrate-invertebrate distinction that is traditionally drawn in ethics and policy is evolutionarily unsound and possibly morally pernicious. Next, I'll review the status of invertebrates in public policy and philosophical ethics, and I'm going to suggest that this near-total exclusion of invertebrates is due to a combination of factors, including cognitive biases, which distort moral judgments about invertebrate welfare, and false beliefs about the capabilities of tiny brains. And finally, I'll consider some normative worries that bringing invertebrates into the moral community could stretch the concept of moral standing too thin, or that it could be too demanding of moral agents. The term vertebrate is biologically sound. It refers to a group of animals that comprise a subphylum vertebrata, which are then characterized by segmented spinal column and cranium enclosed brains. Given this, one might be forgiven for expecting its rhetorical counterpart, invertebrate, to be biologically sound as well. This, you might not be surprised, is not the case. In fact, invertebrates are neither a proper clade nor a proper morphological grade. They are not a proper clade because they don't share a single common ancestor that is not also shared with vertebrates. For instance, echinoderms, such as sea stars and sea urchins, which are classic invertebrates, are more closely related to vertebrates than they are to other invertebrates. And so the category invertebrate doesn't pick out a natural evolutionary group. The category invertebrate also doesn't represent a proper morphological grade of complexity. All animals, vertebrates and invertebrates, show the same amount of cellular differentiation and thus of complexity in their parts. Neither does the category reflect a brain complexity grade. Features of the vertebrate body plans, such as spines and craniums, are not preconditions for complex brains. Some insects, spiders, and crustaceans, as well as mollusks, lack these features, but they boast relatively large, modular, and fairly interconnected brains, depending on which animal we're talking about. Whether brain differences between vertebrates and invertebrates make a moral difference is a separate question, and this is one that I'll get into shortly. So in short, the vertebrate-invertebrate distinction fails as a biological concept. Worse still, it lumps the vast diversity of non-vertebrate animal life into a single category, grouping creatures like the behaviorally flexible paper wasp, whose tiny body contains complex centralized brain, with filter-feeding sea sponges that lack nervous and motor capacities altogether. And this lumping indicates that the vertebrate-invertebrate distinction might also fail as a moral concept. And this leads into a deeper worry about the vertebrate-invertebrate distinction, namely its potential to distort moral analysis and policy, especially in the context of biomedical experimentation. Now, a very general lesson emerging from the philosophical literatures on race, gender, innateness, disability, disease, is that biological categories often carry implicit normative connotations that shape moral judgment. And the vertebrate-invertebrate contradistinction frames invertebrate animals in terms of what they are not, that is, animals like us, animals that have moral standing, that occupy a high position in the scala naturae, which is an archaic progressivist picture of the history of life, which hopefully you can see in the photo here. And so the worry is that some vertebrate-invertebrate distinction, the distinction, falsely signals not only biological and ecological significance, but also moral significance. Whereas biology has long since moved on and from this outdated, value-laden classification, bioethics is still very much encumbered by it. And these moral connotations have likely shaped the philosophy and policy of invertebrates. With respect to policy, International Animal Care and Use Committees, or IACUCs as they're fortunately known, which govern the treatment of animals in science and medicine, have been slow to develop guidelines for invertebrate animals. Major scientific granting agencies in the US, such as, for example, the NIH, only request information about the proposed use of vertebrate animals. European Union rules regarding the use of animals in scientific research likewise covers only vertebrates and other chordates, with a single exception for cephalopod mollusks, such as octopuses, squid, and cuttlefish. And perhaps most ironically, efforts to replace research animals with more ethically sound alternatives, known as the 3Rs approach, that is replacement, reduction, refinement, have actually led some researchers to replace vertebrates not with human tissue or computer models, but with invertebrate animals. And philosophical accounts of animal welfare have done little to challenge this policy dichotomy. Most accounts have focused on mammals, and most recently birds and perhaps on occasion fishes. Bioethics have almost entirely avoided critical engagement with invertebrates. And to the extent that invertebrates are discussed at all, this is largely limited to the instrumental contributions they make to the health and stability of ecosystems. Philosophers of science, meanwhile, have recently begun to explore implications of invertebrate behavior in neurobiology for theories of cognition and consciousness. But when it comes to articulating the ethical implications of this work, they have typically demurred. One of the only explicit philosophical treatments of the moral standing of invertebrate animals is due to the philosopher of science, Peter Carruthers. His ethical analysis, his analysis of the science is solid. I'm gonna say that his ethics leaves much to be desired. According to Carruthers, some invertebrates, such as honeybees and jumping spiders, likely possess a belief desire psychology similar to our own. This, in turn, generates morally significant interest and, as a consequence, makes them prima facie subjects of moral concern. However, he argues, we are under no all things considered obligation to care about their welfare precisely because they are invertebrates. In other words, their status as invertebrates is adequate grounds for their moral exclusion. He concludes that the invertebrate case presents a problem for traditional animal ethics, which must either extend moral consideration to invertebrates, which he takes to be absurd, or rescind it from non-human animals, which is his preferred conclusion. So in effect, Carruthers seems to suggest that the invertebrate case serves as a kind of reductio against the leading accounts of moral standing for all non-human animals. I have a quote here that we can read later. Oh, I'm sorry, the slides don't appear as they ought to, but. But why think that extending moral consideration to some invertebrates is intuitively absurd? And why should this counterintuitive implication require that we reject an otherwise coherent and well-worked-out theory of moral standing? Carruthers offers no real sustained defense of these conclusions. But when a moral theory conflicts with a moral judgment, there's an open question as to which one we should keep or modify. Our theory of moral standing, rather than our specific judgments about our vertebrates in this case. One context in which we should opt to reject specific moral judgments rather than to discard or modify an established moral theory is when we have reason to think that the specific judgments are vulnerable to distorting influences. Indeed, there are a number of cognitive biases that are likely to distort ethical intuitions about the moral standing of invertebrates. And these call into question the basic moral intuitions on which Carruthers' view rests, namely, that extending moral standing to invertebrates is patently absurd. Now, although Carruthers' ethical analysis is unpersuasive, and I will have more to say about this later, his views do, in fact, reflect the attitudes toward invertebrate welfare among the general population, including bioethicists and policymakers. To many, it is simply self-evident that invertebrates are just not the kinds of animals about whom we have to care morally. But I think that this common intuition may stem from a combination of moral cognitive biases, false empirical beliefs, and worries about extending moral standing to certain invertebrates. So let's turn to the cognitive biases first. I suspect that a range of biases may have covertly influenced judgments about the moral standing of invertebrates, and thus have played a causal role in their exclusion from subject-centered moral consideration. Now, it's well known that empathy modulates moral judgment. That should say reciprocity. Individuals tend to morally favor those with whom they contingently empathize over those with whom they do not. And people tend to empathize with individuals who look more like them, who are judged to be more attractive, have Hope Hicks over there, with whom they have a history of reciprocity, and whom they consider to be members of the in-group. By contrast, people tend to have less empathy for those who are less familiar, less subjectively attractive, or who belong to an out-group, such as a disfavored race, or ethnicity, or nationality, and so on. And empathy, or more accurately, its absence, is likely to influence judgments about moral standing, which helps to explain widespread moral attitudes toward invertebrates. Invertebrates score low on the human empathy attribution scale for a number of reasons. First, the vast majority of invertebrates are rarely considered attractive, cute, or cuddly, like the jumping spider on your right. And for this reason, their needs tend not to elicit much empathetic concern. Second, invertebrates such as arthropods and mollusks are almost maximally dissimilar from tetrapod vertebrates like ourselves. Features of invertebrate body plans are radically unlike those of vertebrates. Distinct larval phases are common to invertebrates, but alien to us, as are certain forms of society, like caste-based eusociality or swarm behavior. And indeed, these characteristics may trigger other cognitive biases that then reinforce moral exclusion. And this overall morphological and behavioral alienness makes the empathy gap particularly difficult to bridge. It may be tempting to treat the empathy gap as a legitimate source of moral intuitions or grounding for moral judgments, as Carruthers and some bioconservative ethicists seem to do, I'm thinking here of Leon Cass. But this would be problematic for several reasons. First, the human empathetic response evolved to home in on human psychology, and so it may be a poor guide to understanding non-human animals and their needs, particularly for non-mammalian and especially non-vertebrate animals. Human beings have well-known tendencies to favor faces with certain kinds of features. Large, expressive, camera-type eyes, an inviting smile, symmetrical features, and so on. And to find these attractive and disarming. But humans tend to express negative moral attitudes about subjectively unattractive beings. Beyond this, humans are highly akin to subtle changes in facial expression, and our many facial muscles are capable of broadcasting a wide range of beliefs, desires, and emotions. As a consequence, we may find ourselves ill at ease when confronted with an impassive or unexpressive face on an animal that evolution did not equip with such abilities. Fishes fall into this category, as would insects, to the extent that they're large enough for humans to see their faces. Faces that are adorned by large compound eyes that are unlikely to garner the cuteness responses that typically trigger empathy. When it comes to sparsely haired, slimy, squishy, scurrying, swarming animals, the empathy gap may run deeper than for merely unattractive animals, provoking not apathy, but disgust. The disgust response in humans probably first evolved to help early humans avoid pathogens and infectious agents, but there's evidence that it was later co-opted to mediate social interactions. In particular, disgust appears to modulate moral judgment, and even more fundamentally, judgments about moral standing. Disgust appears to play an important role in driving morally exclusionary norms and behaviors, and indeed, nativist and racist propaganda draw explicitly on the disgust response in portraying immigrants and other races or ethnicities as disease-bearing vermin, or as insects, like cockroaches, or as parasitic free riders. Although the science is not yet settled, it is quite plausible that disgust responses can distort moral judgments and policies, as they appear to have done in cases like interracial marriage, homosexuality, GMOs, and so on. We don't know exactly how disgust features in moral exclusion, but it's highly plausible that disgust has served to reinforce bigoted moral judgments and institutions and made it harder to subject them to pursue critical scrutiny. And this is likely to be true for invertebrates as well. If invertebrates score low on the empathy scale, they earn high marks on the scale of disgust. Most insects and spiders tend to provoke a really strong disgust response in humans, so much so that classroom pictures of arthropods are sometimes preceded by a trigger warning, at least in the US. Priming for disgust has been shown experimentally to increase the moral disapproval directed at human agents. And we might expect it to operate similarly, if not more intensely, when directed at beings like invertebrates that are themselves the direct objects of the disgust. In addition, many arthropods map genetically onto categories that are associated with parasite, and others are mapped onto categories associated with other physical dangers. Although in fact, very few of them in fact represent a danger. And because of this, they often provoke overgeneralized aggression and avoidance. This type of response might be an adaptive heuristic for managing evolutionary risk, but it's not a legitimate basis for ascriptions of moral standing. And in fact, it is likely to distort such judgments. The opposite of the disgust response is what Sherman and Haake called the cuteness response. Cuteness promotes the desire for increased social engagement with a cute being, whereas disgust leads to avoidance and disengagement from the disgust-provoking being. And disengaging from disgust-provoking beings correlates with failing to attribute or else under-attributing mental states to those beings. This, in turn, could subjectively justify moral disengagement. In contrast, the cuteness response enhances the tendency to infer mental states, and this, in turn, feeds back into empathetic concern, leading to moral inclusion. Even if empathy and disgust are not polar opposite emotions, they do appear to have opposite effects on moral judgment and inclusion. Empathy tends to motivate a positive engagement with the empathized, whereas disgust tends to result in disengagement. And so it shouldn't be surprising that disgust-provoking animals like arthropods and invertebrates will tend to be excluded from any morality that relies on empathetic concern. Now, there are several other cognitive biases that are likely to shape ethical attitude toward invertebrates. These biases might not be limited to the invertebrate issue, but there's reason to think that they're especially salient in the invertebrate case. And the first is what we might call a size threshold bias. Consider the lobster. Though less behaviorally and neuroanatomically sophisticated than a jumping spider or a bumblebee, the lobster often appears as an appropriate subject of moral concern. We feel empathy toward the lobster, but not the spider. One reason for this might be that we eat lobsters, but not spiders, which might make us reflect more on our actions regarding the lobster, but not the spider. Still, I think something more appears to drive our intuitions here, and this might be a difference in size. Animals that fall below a certain size threshold tend to fall off the moral radar, so to speak, and apparently below the threshold of moral standing. The size threshold bias might be a useful moral heuristic if there were an actual relationship between size and the characteristics that give rise to moral standing. For example, if size below a certain threshold were to guarantee the absence of, say, phenomenal consciousness, cognition, then we might have a reason to use size as a proxy for moral standing. And one might think that size tracks moral standing because small body size indicates small brains, and tiny brains, it might be thought, cannot in principle support cognition or sentience. But this expectation doesn't seem to be borne out by the evidence, as I'll discuss in a moment. And so the size threshold bias is properly characterized as a moral bias rather than as a useful moral heuristic. Another size bias relates not to individuals but to populations. And this is the tendency to value individuals less when they're members of a numerous class. You may not know this, but ants alone account for roughly 20% of the animal biomass on Earth. So these large numbers may lead to the erroneous judgment that each member of the group is therefore replaceable. For conservationist purposes, the judgment may be correct. But this, of course, glosses over the subject-centered moral value of the animals themselves, which is obviously unrelated to the size of populations they comprise or how they interact ecologically with other species. And this is as true of the case of ants as it is with elephants. The population size bias is related to but distinct from another potential bias, which we might call the de-individualization bias. And this is the tendency to see some individual insects as parts of a larger individual, the colony, which outlives them, rather than as agents that are eligible for moral concern in their own right. This leads to another possible source of moral bias, the lifespan threshold bias. Some invertebrates live very short lives, about 1 to 3 years in the case of the common octopus, a bit less for a house-raised jumping spider, and a fleeting 30 or so days for the summer worker honeybee. Folk moral intuitions may suggest that animals with so little time left make comparably smaller moral claims on us. Even if this were so, moral standing itself cannot depend on the amount of time one has left. If it did, then moral standing of humans would change as people grew older or when they fell terminally ill. Nor does lifespan neatly track relative moral status. Many mammals, for instance, live comparatively shorter lives than other vertebrates, such as, for example, crocodiles and tuna. But this does not affect the higher moral status attributed to them. And of course, trees and giant clams live for many generations, and at least one jellyfish is immortal. Perhaps instead, lifespan serves as a heuristic, such that beings which fall below a certain lifespan threshold are unlikely to possess the mental properties that ground moral standing. Here's how that argument might go. An adaptive strategy for short-lived animals might be to develop rigid behavioral routines rather than cognitive machinery that is needed for learning. This might be because learning is time-intensive and such animals have very little time. Thus, short-lived animals might be unlikely to evolve complex cognitive machinery, making the lifespan bias, in fact, a useful heuristic for identifying morally relevant characteristics. This view might be intuitively plausible, but it also runs afoul of the evidence to which I now turn. So we've seen that there are a number of cognitive biases that might distort judgment about invertebrates. But the most defensible rationale for their moral exclusion is the belief that they lack the properties of mind that generate psychological interests, and which are then thought to be preconditions for moral standing. But the assumption that tiny brains can't sustain complex thought is problematic for several reasons that I'll go into now. First of all, measurements of absolute brain size tell us much less than is often assumed. The ratio of brain to body size, known as the encephalization quotient, or EQ, is more informative because it indicates that there has been differential evolutionary investment in a metabolically costly brain tissue. And this, in turn, suggests that the fitness payoff must be especially high to sustain these costs. And the payoff, presumably, is paid out in cognitive functionality that the increased brain power provides. But even if EQ is predictive of cognitive ability, then things like total neuron number, modularity, connectivity, metabolic rate, microstructural features, and so on, are actually more predictive. And crucially, these features do not scale linearly with size, which suggests that even tiny brains may possess the absolute raw material for their own form of thought and feeling. We can see how factors like neuron number are more predictive than absolute brain size if we look at the case of avian brains. Birds, such as parrots and crows, are capable abstract thinkers and problem solvers. But behavioral evidence for their cognitive sophistication was long greeted with skepticism for two reasons. First, bird brains are very small. And second, they lack a structure that physically resembles the mammalian neocortex, which was long thought necessary for any form of complex cognition, any form of complex thought, or even consciousness. It's only recently that researchers have come to understand exactly how, maybe not exactly is the wrong word, but just how avian brains solve the engineering problem of fitting substantial computational power into a very small package, which of course is crucial for birds since flight is metabolically and mechanically costly. It turns out that bird brains contain a much larger number of densely packed neurons compared with similarly sized mammalian brains. And these densities are especially high in a region associated with complex cognition, which is the functional equivalent of mammalian neocortex. Not only are neurons more densely configured, but they're also smaller. And this allows more neurons to fit into a smaller volume. This gives birds increased pound-for-pound computational potential beyond the capacity of monkeys, which have much larger brains, but who aren't subject to the biomechanical constraints of flight. Like birds, many invertebrates have to deal with significant size constraints. And these constraints are severe for insects and arachnids. This is due to the nature of their body plans and the laws of physics. So first of all, they can't grow beyond a certain size, lest they collapse under the weight of their own exoskeleton. And second, they have these organs for respiration that are distributed throughout the body. And because volume increases faster than surface area, this presents yet another scaling constraint. And these constraints place upper limits on the size of their bodies and therefore of their brains. And so we might ask, if evolution has found a way to pack a large amount of computational power into the small brains of birds, might it have done the same for the absolutely tiny brains of arthropods? There is, in fact, evidence for such solutions. First, neural network models suggest that some forms of cognition may actually be computationally inexpensive and can be accomplished with only a small number of neurons, something that can easily be handled by the pin-sized brains of insects and spiders. Such models offer a kind of proof of concept. So as Jeremy Niven and Lars Chitka point out, it's hard to imagine that millions upon millions of generations of evolution would not have arrived at solutions that were arrived at by models that they run. And in fact, the brains of many insects, spiders, cephalopods, do appear to possess structural characteristics that might support sophisticated forms of cognition. For example, insects, spiders, and octopuses have central processing regions. These receive and integrate information from various peripheral systems. And in insects and spiders, these are called mushroom bodies. And in octopuses, these are called the vertical lobes. These regions are connected by so-called reentrant pathways. And these permit the ongoing and bidirectional exchange of signals. These give animals centralized control over their bodies and their actions. And in fact, smaller size may actually confer certain advantages that aren't available to larger brains. For example, smaller brains tend to have smaller and denser neurons. We saw how this works with birds. And this means that they also have shorter distances between neurons. Why is this important? Well, it shrinks the distance that information has to travel, and it reduces conduction delays, allowing for faster thinking. Now, smaller brains also impose constraints on cognition, but the point for now is that just like it is with computers, bigger is not necessarily better. Still, brain tissue is extremely metabolically costly, and so we should expect to see increases, we should expect increased brain size to bring with it a substantial behavioral and thus cognitive payoff as well. And there is now a fair amount of behavioral evidence showing how at least some invertebrates put these brains to good use. In the interest of time, I will move through this a bit quickly, but I'm happy to return to it in Q&A. So for example, among insects, honeybees appear to be capable of cross-modal learning. So that is, they're capable of transferring a rule like sameness indicates reward that was learned in a visual context to a different, say, olfactory context. Paper wasps recognize faces of their conspecifics, and this allows them to navigate dynamic social hierarchies that other insects don't face. Bumblebees engage in social learning and can learn complex and highly non-instinctive tasks like string pulling, and I actually have a video if anybody is interested in during the Q&A of a bumblebee pulling out a reward. And ants appear to pass the mirror self-recognition test, which human infants only pass around month 22. Cephalopod mollusks, everyone's favorite invertebrate, such as octopuses and cuttlefish, have excellent spatial navigation abilities. Octopuses excel at problem solving, and they may even use rudimentary tools. Among arachnids, the tiny, tiny, tiny jumping spider rapidly and flexibly switches from stalking its prey by crouching behind a leaf to executing a long detour to an ambush location located just above its prey. This detouring ability suggests that jumping spiders might be using mental maps. If so, then they are capable of surprisingly sophisticated representational thinking. What's more, the jumping spider Portia africana on your right over there can distinguish between one, two, and many. So these are numerosity abilities, again, at the level of human infants. Some researchers were initially skeptical that such flexible behaviors could be generated by the tiny brains of insects and spiders. And thus, they operated on the assumption that there must be simpler, non-cognitive causes of this behavior. But the combined weight of the neuroscientific and behavioral evidence, I think, suggests that complex cognition may be much more broadly distributed in the trio of animal life. And, as we will see, some forms of cognition may implicate consciousness, while others may be necessary for forming stable preferences. If so, then some forms of cognition might implicate morally protectable interests. But cognitive ability alone may be insufficient for moral standing. If there is no subjective experience, nothing it is like to be that system, then even if the organism has psychological interests in some sense, those interests cannot be said to matter to it. And thus, its interests cannot be said to matter morally. Phenomenal consciousness, in other words, seems to be a precondition for moral standing, for having well-being in any meaningful psychological sense. So, are any invertebrates phenomenally conscious? Or do they are they just sophisticated biological zombies? There is, of course, no agreement about just how to define or operationalize consciousness. On some accounts, consciousness is a continuous basal property of brains, including invertebrate brains. For example, Tononi's information integration theory of consciousness holds that phenomenal consciousness just is the integration of information, that's it. The more informationally integrated a system, the more conscious that system is. If this view is right, then even organisms with very simple nervous systems are conscious, albeit to minimal degrees that are of questionable moral import. Others have argued that there are two fundamental abilities that implicate phenomenal consciousness. One perceptual and one motivational. And there's evidence that some invertebrates like insects and spiders might have both. These are sensory binding, which is the ability to perceive disparate elements of a perceptual scene as a single coherent whole, and directed attention, that is, the ability to direct one's perceptual focus at will. The evidence for these abilities is broad-based. First, it may be computationally cheaper, and so more accessible to tiny brains, to perceive objects as discrete wholes, rather than to detect many individual features of objects and then to keep track of their ever-changing relationships. At the neurobiological level, the same reentrant pathways that allow for information integration may also support sensory binding and directed attention. And these are also present in insects and cephalopods. Another line of support comes from the evolutionary hypothesis that phenomenal consciousness emerged as an adaptive response to information processing challenges of active lifestyles. For example, mobile animals need to transform dynamic, multi-sensory inputs into a coherent scene as distinct from the animal's own movements. And they also need to pick out relevant cues from heterogeneous environments. And thus, on this view, all mobile animals, unlike their distant sessile cousins, should be expected to have some degree of phenomenal consciousness. But bare phenomenal consciousness may not be sufficient for moral standing. As Guy Kahane and Julian Savulescu point out in a joint article, bare subjectivity is probably not sufficient to generate psychological interests. If an organism has moral standing, that organism must presumably be capable of judging, in some very rudimentary sense, that certain states of affairs are desirable and others undesirable. And this is where affective states come into the picture. What then can we say about the effect of worlds of invertebrates? Again, the scientific study of affect among invertebrates is still fairly new, but emerging findings suggest that some insects and perhaps spiders have emotion-like states, and that in some invertebrates, these emotions are mediated by dopamine, which is the same hormone that regulates emotion in humans. For example, bumblebees tend to interpret ambiguous stimuli more optimistically after being exposed to a pleasant stimulus, which is just what humans do when we're happy. And both fruit flies and bees respond more pessimistically after exposure to an aversive stimulus, something like vigorous shaking. And again, this is something that humans do when we're sad or stressed. And just as perceptual binding is a pervasive feature of some arthropods and mollusks, so too is what we might call semantic binding, wherein objects are classified in real time into ecologically relevant categories, such as predator, prey, mate, obstacle, and so on, and appropriate affective valences are attached to these categories. In other words, the worlds of these animals is, at least in a very rudimentary sense, meaningful. But of all affective states, what's perhaps most at the center of moral analysis is pain perception. Many invertebrates have receptors called nociceptors, which allow for the rapid detection and response to noxious stimuli. But pain detection is not conclusive evidence of pain perception. The leading adaptive explanation is that pain perception facilitates instrumental learning. And this helps animals to avoid future exposure to noxious animals, not just to run away immediately. If pain teaches animals which situations to avoid, then an animal that is capable of instrumental learning might also be expected to be capable of experiencing pain. And there is some evidence of instrumental learning among invertebrates, including some mollusks and insects. Other markers of pain perception include behaviors like grooming of injured body parts, as has been shown in shrimp, as well as what is known as motivational trade-off. For example, hermit crabs are apparently willing to withstand a mild electric shock in order to obtain a more desirable shell, but not a stronger shock or a less desirable shell. In addition, endogenous opioids which modulate pain perception in humans have also been found in invertebrates. But on the other hand, some insects appear to engage in normal feeding and mating behaviors, even after sustaining severe injuries, such as dismembered in the case of the mantis. Either these animals don't mind the pain, or else they judge it to be a fair price for the encounter. So it is possible that some invertebrates do not experience pain in the way that vertebrates typically do. But even if this is the case, they might still have rich, phenomenal, and effective worlds. And these worlds could plausibly give rise to morally protectable psychological interests. So we might not want to be so quick as to infer from differential pain phenomenologies and responses that invertebrates are mere zombie automata. In this way, the case of invertebrate pain perception might press us to reconsider traditional approaches to non-human animal moral standing, to the extent that these have typically centered around vertebrate-centric understandings of pain and its behavioral correlates. This evidence suggests that some invertebrates may have characteristics that ground moral standing. But a reliable evidence base requires reliable inferential strategies, and drawing reliable inferences about invertebrate cognition is especially challenging given how alien their brains, their bodies, their life ways, their evolutionary histories are. So there's bound to be greater uncertainty about the presence of morally relevant cognitive properties among invertebrates. The science of comparative cognition tends to cope with uncertainty by erring on the side of avoiding false positives, that is, avoiding wrongly ascribing sophisticated cognition to, or consciousness for that matter, to animals. This may or may not be a good approach, but this could be a problem if the ethics takes its cues about the existence of morally relevant properties from the science. Because the kind of burden of proof that might be warranted on the side of ethics is different from the burden of proof that's warranted in science. One way that bioethicists deal, or at least might deal with this, is by implementing a sort of precautionary approach, or some other approach that errs on the side of avoiding false negatives. But there are limits to the plausibility and desirability of precaution as an action-guiding heuristic. And one thing that we might do if we want to develop a scientifically engaged animal ethics is, one thing that we need to do is to justify and reconcile these competing error avoidance strategies. So finally, let's turn to one last reason for the exclusion of invertebrates. Earlier, I suggested that the fact that people don't empathize with invertebrates is not sufficient grounds to deny them moral standing, as Carruthers wants to do. The idea that there's a tight connection between empathy and moral standing is quite obviously inconsistent with prevailing subject-centered accounts of moral standing. These accounts aren't grounded in our tendency to empathize with individuals of a particular sort, or for that matter, in any other relational property. Instead, these are grounded in the possession of certain morally relevant psychological properties. Different psychological capabilities might confer different moral statuses, or moral standings of different weights. And these might give rise to more expansive or more truncated sets of rights and or morally protectable interests. But the point that Carruthers' style objections miss is that any plausible account of moral standing can't be premised on contingent sociological patterns of empathetic concern, especially when those concerns might be distorted by cognitive biases and false beliefs. We might contingently sympathize with individuals of different races, different ethnicities, different genders, different animal taxa. Or we might not. We might include some individuals in our cooperative groups, or we may not. But our contingent sympathies, reciprocity relations, other non-subject-centered facts cannot be the source of moral protections. Okay, but suppose that the science is settled, and that we're confident that some invertebrates do have morally protectable interests. Now what? Suppose also that this leads us to accept that some invertebrates have moral standing, at least on our best theory of moral standing. Could we still have defensible reasons for excluding invertebrates from the moral calculus? Well, one reason for still excluding them might be that extending moral standing to invertebrates could make morality overly demanding, and hence ultimately implausible. There are good reasons to think that moral theories must be minimally psychologically realistic for beings like us, as Owen Flanagan argues. And the worry is that requiring that the requirements of this new and more inclusive morality would grind life to a veritable halt. People would be morally accountable for every insect that meets its end on our windshield, every spider they failed to rescue from the bathtub, every squashed mosquito, every population of fleas sacrificed for the comfort of a companion animal. People would have to effectively sweep the floor before them like Janus monks, so as to avoid stepping on scurrying beetles and ants. And this is to say nothing of biking and driving. Worse, the entire modern agricultural system would be morally suspect. This is given its no-holds-barred battle with crop-eating insects. And of course, biomedical benefits to humans could potentially be foregone if invertebrates are afforded even minimal protections in clinical and basic research. People would have to either submit to a radical change in lifestyle or to count as their role in the suffering of trillions of beings. The first option would be too difficult in practice. The second would impose psychological burden that is too heavy, too alienating from our personal projects for most people to bear. And so the extension of moral standing to invertebrates should be rejected, or so the argument goes. Well, the first reply is that extending basic protections to invertebrates in the research context, which is the primary focus of this talk, is unlikely to require a dramatic overhaul of common practices, especially because a framework for this is already in place for vertebrates. Subsuming invertebrates into this framework is unlikely to significantly impede or increase the cost of research. And it's important that we don't lose focus here. For example, we can't talk about constraints on our treatment of vertebrates in scientific research without resolving other moral questions, like how we should deal with rodent incursions in our home, or deer that wander onto the highway, and so on. Also, too, we can keep the focus on the ethical treatment of invertebrates in experimental settings without settling all the other moral questions. Still, one may worry that extending invertebrates' moral regard, even in this limited, say, sense, could have ramifications well beyond the experimental context. But there are two reasons to think that the over-demandingness concern in this case may be misplaced. First, I think we should be careful not to assume that even significant inconveniences of abiding by moral theory should count against that moral theory. After all, moral progress in the form of inclusion has often inconvenienced those who have had to cede some real or perceived advantage in order to make room for the flourishing of previously marginalized others, as Alan Buchanan and Russell Powell argue in their forthcoming book. Second, and in this case more importantly, it's just not obvious that moral consideration of invertebrates would in fact lead to impossible to discharge moral obligations, or that it would lead to repugnant moral conclusions. For several reasons. First, while invertebrates vastly outnumber vertebrates, the number of invertebrate species with moral standing may turn out to be very small. Second, the fact that an invertebrate animal has moral standing does not entitle that individual to equal treatment or confer equal moral status. How weighty the interests are, how we should balance them against competing moral claims, depends on unresolved questions about how to reconcile moral interest conflicts and aggregation issues among beings with different moral statuses. And these problems are not, of course, unique to invertebrate ethics. But the point, I think, is that the demandingness problem should be diffused through the resolution of interest conflicts, and not by discarding our best accounts of moral standing, or by arbitrarily excluding these alien beings from our moral community. Thank you.